And so they vacuum the whole thing. And while they're vacuuming, the guy's very careful. I watched him do it. It's a bristle truck and a vacuum cleaner right after the bristles. And he works down every single seam and tries to peel the seams apart. Gets up every rock. And then if they check and wherever it's gotten any kind of problem, they come back and cut it out with a saw. And then they come back and install it the way you guys just did. In other words, they did the big pour the way they did it originally in mass quantity with paper. And then any repairs they do, they come back and cut it out, lift it out, and just and set that little piece with the vibratory to the screen, just like you guys are doing out here. And they've done that for 7 years now. I've never seen any pools of water on it anywhere, and I've been out there like 2.5 to 3 inch rains, and the water goes way faster than the only mistake was that we let the water run out onto the packed area. If we actually reversed it like I showed in the final picture, we'd have perfect stormwater control.
There's a lot of talk about pressure washing.
I'll see why.
It seems to me that drives the contaminants deeper into the slab. It'd be my preference to flood the slab gently ahead of an aggressive vacuum. And as you pull that water up out of the surface, you're flushing those contaminants up.
That vacuum truck is there. That vacuum truck is plenty.
Yeah. Oh yeah, if it's coming,
it's pointing.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what distance from building foundations, especially buildings with basements, like if you have a residential use where somebody wants to do a pervious concrete driveway, how far from the building?
You can put it up next to the building, but the shape of the recharge head comes into play. That should be directed away from the foundation, 3 or 4 feet. The pavement's not so much an issue as where that water's going once it passes.
Right, but if that's on a zero, like you said, grade, and it's within the lot, it's basically a hole in the ground, probably leveling their basement wall. So,
problems. I mean, if you look at rain gardens, you're doing basically the same thing.
But it's 10 feet, NDE, right, the downtown distance, are 10 feet from the house. So I would say to be safe, you're saying these things are probably going to be no closer than 10 feet to a house.
We're really replicating what happens in natural soil. You know, we're trying to accomplish what environmental impact a raindrop has when it falls on a grassy field.
But I'm figuring that, what I've seen, like from the county's dry well standards, they're calling for 10 feet, depending on maybe what else you got going there. 20 feet from the foundation wall, just so you don't get the water coming preferentially back in. I'm trying to figure out. Maybe what you do is you can do the porous concrete up right up to the house or right up to the walkway or whatever, but you don't let the reservoir get within
10 feet. I think that would be probably the best approach, because usually you have a fair amount of frontage out in front of, you know, from the house. And if you could get that into a dry well system, basically is what you're creating using the porous pavement, and then bring it to the dry well system, maybe applicable. And again, that materials that are on site. Some places in Montgomery County, especially, there's nice clay soils, and you could probably put that thing right against the house, but you'd never infiltrate in.
Somebody will tell me it did. And then I guess my follow-up another question I'm going to ask is, what's the maximum number or multiplier that you can put on this calculation for you that you do when you're going? You could have a 2-to-1 ratio, or you've got twice as much previous one.
3-to-1, or what would be the number there? You start with the same problem we had with infiltration in the past, where people would take
the entire subdivision
is
one little hole.
We have had people in the past put the whole site together, like, you know, 50 acres of pavement, and create a vertical chimney that's, you know, 20 feet wide, 30 feet long, and has a little area at the bottom, and put all the water straight down and say, well, that's all going to go underground. Right? And it does for a week until that seals up, and then you have a complete failure. Right, right.
So there is some practical limit. You want to spread this water out as much as possible. I did all that math to show the variety of possibilities there. I surely wouldn't let anybody go over about. I would think 2 to 1, we have twice as much pavement, you know, non-porous pavement to the porous area. But it's not the amount of porous so much as it's the reservoir. You could easily have, number 57 is a reservoir stem. Say a layer of sand or some other, or the number 8s. And then the 57s is a reservoir. Have a porous pavement here in a level area. Then have, say, a regular concrete or blacktop. Another level. And you could have the reservoir run under all of them. You could use the same stone as the base for everything. Then your reservoir should put out over the whole site. Right? So that's the same as having porous through the whole site, if you do it that way. But if you're actually using non-porous material and porous material, and that's all the reservoir area, I would give 2 to 1 on the absolute, you know, something like that would be your absolute maximum.
You're the other one that was talking about the ratios.
Well, I was saying, if you think about the curve number, bring it back to this effective curve number criteria, calculations I did were all assuming that the drainage area, the pavement area, and the infiltration area. So if you double the drainage area, you've got twice as much water. Triple it, you've got 3 times as much. Pretty soon your curve numbers go way up. Now you could probably engineer it to make it work, but the question is, why do all that engineering and that expense to go from curve number 98 to curve number 90? When that's when, as I say, I think it becomes a value engineering decision. And I think a lot of these absolute lines in the sand that are in the code now that were designed to be conservative and avoid failure are going to kind of not be issues when you have
trouble. It's going to have a limit. Like, it's going to say 10 feet of this country. Unless they change it. The current draft has it set up to have a minimum, just like the other one, with this
country. Apply both reservoir underneath.
Correct. They won't be thinking in terms of separate. They will say, let's enforce pavement, because they're imagining it, the reservoir line right up at the edge of the pavement.
Stuart, in your calculation with the drainage area, the infiltration area, the pavement area, can you define the pavement area?
It's just the footprint of the pervious pavement.
Okay.
And in a sense, for design purposes, it almost becomes irrelevant in terms of size. Where it really becomes relevant is if you put in a pervious pavement strip as wide as this table with a 500-foot asphalt parking lot draining on it, expecting all that sheet flow to infiltrate in 3 feet. That's where it started.
It's really the drainage area and the infiltration area that's
right. But I put it in pavement, and this is something I think that I hear a lot of confusion about when I talk to folks, because you typically think of the simple plots that we see where the drainage area, the pavement area, and the infiltration area are all the same.
Right.
We dig a hole, we fill it with stone, pave it, and there's no contributing drainage area. Even slight variations from that simple configuration start to get confusing. You have people thinking we can put pervious strips in parking lots and other parking lot will infiltrate because there's pervious concrete.
Right. So the pavement area is almost like the road
size. It's the size you're in.
Well, the pavements could include hard pavement, and its flow would be directed into that.
Right, but in that equation, it's on the pervious.
But his question, he wrote the code, he's going to be
right. Correct.
So a part to that question is you have communities that are 5, 10 years old, built out. Everything's designed to drain away from the house or elsewhere. Pervious pavement takes off. 20 people in this 100 house community decide, hey, I want pervious confidence. Now we're directing different volumes of water as an installer of concrete towards county aprons, towards county roads, whether they be asphalt or concrete. Over time, we're going to undermine the integrity of county roads and aprons if somebody wanted to drive over the coast.
By making the soils wetter? You mean by introducing more stormwater in? I think you'd get a strong indicator if you looked at what was going on there before the site was developed. Before anybody came, did it have runoff coming into that area, or was it shedding off another area?
You got water shedding off of the street and stormwater tunnel.
Right. Right.
Now we have water traveling underneath the driveways.
Right.
Potentially undermining county roads, subdivision roads.
With typical pavement and flexible pavement?
Either one. I'm asking, as did that be a foreseeable problem?
Let me draw your question out a little bit more. So this optimistic world we're all working towards, where everyone wants to have pervious concrete, it's useful to think about, why do they want pervious concrete? What are they putting that pervious concrete into? You have existing drainage systems. People want dry driveways. What would make someone put in a pervious concrete system? You're still designing it for stormwater management, so it's not entirely clear.
Well, I guess to what the issue might be is it goes out the neighborhood.
Yeah.
They want to add additional residential homes.
Okay.
So they...
On-site control.
So this is going to mitigate against additional on-site controls if they can talk to existing homeowners and put it in. I don't know why a homeowner would want to...
Or 3 years after you start putting some driveways up, you know, you get a call from the county, hey, our road's failing, it's collapsing. We've determined that you're washing out our... Road foundation.
My foundation is
the moisture's going down instead of lowering. I think what you're describing is kind of a more broad area than it really is. Where this happens, that water's moving over there.
What your question suggests to me is sort of a broader issue with distributed stormwater control. Mm-hmm. Whether you're infiltrating water with pervious concrete or bioretention cells. I mean, we as hydrologists don't really have the science today to answer the question if every home in a 50-acre development with 100 single-family homes puts a rain garden in their front yard, what's the cumulative effect on the local water table? We can't quite answer that question. That's real fine-scale heterogeneity. And the heterogeneity of the subsoils, we model that as sort of an average saturated hydraulic conductivity like it's a big black box. But if you ever go out and make those measurements, talk to some folks at lunch, you know, over spatial scales of 10 or 20 meters, we routinely see variations in saturated hydraulic conductivity of 2 orders of magnitude. So the landscape soil is a real complex medium. And to predict the cumulative effect of lots of infiltration, whether it's through pervious concrete or any of these other practices, is not something we're really well equipped to do. That's part of the reason when we do individual site designs, individual practice designs rather than site designs, we load them up with big margins of safety. But just looking at the topography or the soils in a little hand core, can't really confidently predict, put an infiltration practice, where that water's going to end up over the course of a year or several years. There's a lot of uncertainty there. And that's why we design conservatively.
Excuse me, are you a contractor?
Did
you get a
building
permit?
For a driveway?
Well, you did, you're saying.
So
we can see what happens when we don't do this. If you have a lot of urban development, you've in effect built a giant funnel. From the roofs, all the hard pavement, all this is collecting, the running off. And if that condition is highly developed now, you will starve the aquifer. What it originally had as a resupply of stormwater moving down into the aquifer becomes starved out. There are places in LA where this has happened so intensely that they've dropped the water table so much that seawater is migrating into that and the wells are becoming salty. Because they've dropped that water table that way. Heavy urban development is starving out that natural resupply.
Installation question. On past installations that you've seen or been aware of, if it's in an area where the viewer hasn't looked at a porous parking surface, do they require you to put in a secondary means of conveyance into the reservoir underneath the concrete? Yeah, like for example, like a trench drain with a manifold system coming back, inlet with, you know, again, manifold system. I mean, are you running into where they're comfortable enough with the performance of this where the porous concrete is the conveyance method, or have you run into, well, we like the idea, but it's, why don't you do this too?
Go ahead, Stu.
I can maybe answer part of that. Uh-huh. We've done quite a few projects, and some of the projects weren't perked. So they had unknown soils on how fast it was going to perk into the ground.
Okay.
So they put the right amount of stone in what they thought, and they did put an underground structure in. To, if anything did happen, then there'd be a source of that water to go somewhere.
Okay. I think my question is more as the performance of the porous concrete as a conveyance method into the stone underneath, where reviewers are so unsure of the product, where say somebody accidentally seal coats over it or something, where now what do you do? Is there another means of conveyance so you still meet that stormwater?
For instance, the town in this particular project, the town is on the hook for maintaining that the pavement to be porous and also the structure. And that goes all the way down to the subgrade. If for instance they decided to pave over, the county would have the ability to come back and tell them to dig up what they've done and put new pavement down. There is no supplemental design feature to allow them to convey the water back into the roundabout way back into the stone to
perk into the system. Maintenance agreement, yeah. Over, just like any fit. Agree with you. You're under a maintenance agreement, you're under a requirement, you have to do it. If you don't, you get nailed, I guess. That's the backup is the maintenance. That's the...
Yeah, I agree, but there's a couple things there as well.
You're right. Every 2 years, one of my inspectors goes around and checks. And we do have a right to put it on your tax bill.
That's right. But
the new state manual, which is what's going to be, you know, when my time goes, Stu's time takes over here at the end of next year. For all you all, I guess you all know that, right? The new manual, what he's worked on, his charts for, he took it a step further than I did, a good step, and made it to curves, right? I should have thought of that, I tell you. Okay. He's an academic, I'm just an engineer. But anyway, the new manual is written in two parts. There's a quarter acre, right the way it is right now, assuming it doesn't change, but it may. I mean, I'm making comments, Stu's making comments, there's, you know, a lot of us working on this. There's a quarter acre prescription, just like if you were going to go through the building process and get a house built. If you're going to have to pull a building permit, you don't have to have an engineer draw up your house for you. If you're going to file with the building code, which is all engineered, pre-engineered stuff, and you stay within the building code, you can build a house without getting engineer drawing, right? Everybody does that, right? The new state manual says that up to a quarter acre of this material in Maryland, you won't have to have a full set of engineered drawings, okay? Whoever asked the question, back there, you asked the question. But it has a bunch of caveats. If you're going to do it that way, you have to have relief drains. You have to have an extra way for the water to get in. Okay? And what they're intending for you to do is, you know how I drew that picture, the one that I passed out earlier? I'm sorry. They're intending for you to have the porous concrete here and have the stone project up to the surface along the edges like that. Okay? So that you're going to wind up, if this didn't work for some reason, there's a place for the water to come off the edges and make it down into the bottom. And if you read carefully what's written in the new manual, you'll see that it says that you have to have a relief way, an extra way for the water to get in there, if you're doing it by prescription. Anything over that size, or anytime you want to, you can always do it with an engineer and have them do it for you. And then the engineer put his stamp on it, and, you know, he's
on the hook.
He's got that noose around his neck for anything that goes wrong. And forever. That's right. Forever and ever and then. But that's the way the manual's written. It says that you have to have these relief drains, ways to get in there and ways for the water to get out.
Can you say quarter acre, is that drainage into it or?
Quarter acre of structure.
Okay.
which is, what, 10,000 square feet, which is not huge, but it's not insignificant either.
Would that only apply to residential projects or commercial projects?
It says 1/4 acre. At this point, let me say, remember what this is not an adopted manual yet, right? I was still scratching comments up on the line this morning while everybody else was talking. Every time one of them brought up something I thought was interesting, I was making another line on mine, because I'm still writing comments to the back of the state possibly.
But then the relief system wouldn't have to be engineered either?
It says there has to be. Okay, now what does that mean at the local level? I'm not sure. We'll probably wind up adding criteria in our county saying that's what this means. I'm sorry.
I had a question separate on this, on the water quality aspect of this and the maintenance aspect. When you're talking about your infiltration through the concrete, I'm not so much worried about that. Given the lifespan of it, sooner or later it's going to fail. In addition to just infiltration, what is the water quality benefit? How is it determined how that stuff's being, pollutants are being removed with using this product the way it is? I understand everybody keeps saying bacterial action basically breaking down the hydrocarbons.
Not everyone says.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out, because inspecting stormwater practices like bioretention and stuff, anytime you have a heavily used parking area, you have a skunk. A nasty black thing. It has to be maintained. It clogs up everything, and then sooner or later, it doesn't take 20 years or the life expectancy of the top layer before that clogs. So your base, where your subbase is, where it's going into the ground, basically, starts to clog. Your stones may not be clogged. The concrete may not be clogged, but that base is clogged. Now you're not having any infiltration. And how do you fix that?
Well, a couple questions right there. One is, what's the actual water quality performance and how do you measure? It touches on the question of, is this a BMP or is this an alternative surface? Because in our code, most state codes, we have specific water quality standards that have to demonstrate that it's BMP, that you don't for an alternative surface. And that's, I think, one of the issues that I think is going to get a lot of comments about purpose concrete in the manual. Challenges if you have an alternative surface, the answer is you maintain your pavement. You do that whether it's paved with, it's clogging with debris from oil on fine grain particulates or sand from a garden.
This is the type of fines that you normally see, and especially like commercial parking lots with walls or high traffic areas. I'm not 100% sure it's not coming off the traditional pavement itself. But I would say a good portion is coming from the tires and the oil. That stuff's not going to get back in that. That's not something that I would believe would be easily, it's going to stick to the particles and it's eventually going to filter in. And that's what I've seen happen over 10 years or so of products that are installed. You get a really thick layer of stuff that's just gunk. And I don't have any other real good way to say it, but a shovel's the only way to get it out as opposed to a vacuum.
Well, organic gunk will break down.
Right.
There's a certain amount of brake dust and who knows what nasty stuff comes off the cars, but primarily we're talking about hydrocarbons.
Right. And where is that breaking down at in this process?
As deep as it takes to get dark, just under the surface. Those little guys are living down there.
In traditional stormwater practice, it's extremely concentrated because normally curb cuts or something like that. So, we do have, since you're using the whole base here, you have a substantially larger area to have to clog as opposed to just a curb cut or something like that. But we've had basically sheet flow into some sand filters, and they've clogged at least the first foot. And they're only in use for 10 years. And the one that I'm aware of anyway, and it's literally clogged. To where it's just really sticky stuff, and I can't imagine any bacterial growth is helping break anything down fast enough for it to work. It just seems to me that this is an additional issue.
You're talking about a controlled, you're talking about a storm box, you're talking about it collecting in a certain size area versus this collecting over an entire surface area. I mean, you're talking about a 10,000 square foot surface area, just as far as the minimum system. I don't know.
Well, I think 10,000 square feet of an eighth of an inch is a whole lot of material. I don't know how long it's going to get to that.
The oil and grease don't go deep. They stay in the top half inch.
Well, he's right about that. He do that. He said, but you have to, that, they're hitting the key point. All those, are you, what county are you from? I'm just curious. Okay, because most of the oldest of those sites are in Prince George's County. Most of the oldest of the fire retention sites. And their manual, which the state then adopted, so they take everything. If you listen to this, they take everything from what everybody else plays with, and then it winds from their manual. You know, that's how it works. All said 7%. Whatever the drainage area surface was to it, those fire retention areas were supposed to be around 7% of that area. What Stu's talking about here is just look about alternative purpose, alternative surfaces, it's 100%. It's all this material. So from 7% to 100%, of course, that's quite different. And even if you go like a 1-to-1, it's 7% to 50%, about 7 times greater. So it should take longer for that to happen. I haven't seen it yet on what we have. What we have is 7 years old, it's still not. But I don't, maybe it will. I mean, I'm not totally discounting that, but the size relative to the depth, true distributed treatment ought to delay that.
It's one of the other things, it's not just delaying it, but when you have a concentrated area like you're talking about, it gets so concentrated that the bacteria that normally break down the hydrocarbons can't function effectively. They're overpowered. And you imagine an oil slick happens, it kills the coastline. That's the same thing there. On a large area, when it's dispersed like that, the hydrocarbons do have a chance to get broken down by the naturally occurring bacteria that eat the hydrocarbons.
If I could add one thing to that, it's an interesting point that John had brought up, in that since it'd be interesting to see maybe 40, 50 years from now, when we're removing an existing pervious concrete, removing the base, and going down to that grade level, and seeing what has or has not accumulated, is as we're referring with, say, the biofilters, things like that. I mean, you take out the sand, and on that grade level, you do have that material that just doesn't break down. Of course, we're talking a much larger area, but it's a good point. Some of the oils that perhaps can float up and down through the grade, but they aren't really going through that microbial process. How would that, or should it, affect the stormwater calculations? Say, for instance, if some pervious concrete, because we know what happens, is installed in an area where you have a poorly drained soil, such as just not infiltrating the soil, and all that is collecting at the base, to what point do we know that that's providing water quality? So I guess to expand on your question, how does that affect water quality? That really probably has to do with the infiltration capability of the soil. And is that factored into the water quality equations as to what water quality benefit pervious concrete provides?
I think these are really timely questions. These are actually active research questions. This is kind of a murky area, to be honest with you, in my opinion. If you go to the International BMP database, where people report input concentrations and output concentrations of stormwater retention facilities, that's the basis for much of the removal efficiencies that you see in sort of planning literature. I think there are 8 to 10 pervious concrete systems in there. None of them have influent concentration information. So you can't compute the removal efficiency. That's one extreme. On the other extreme, you have folks will just say, well, as long as we're infiltrating, it's gone. Out of sight, out of mind. Well, we know the world's a little bit more complex than that, too. The thing that really concerns me, that I think is an unanswered question, is we know that many pollutants, not all pollutants, but many pollutants can be retained by soils, different pollutants to a greater or lesser extent in different soils. Not 100% removal efficiency, and not forever. We also know that there are changes in the geochemical environment of soils that happen when you have flushes of salt water from snowmelt runoff that flood the soil matrix with sodium ions that can seep to binding sites, and you can get flushes of metals coming out of the soil. Right? Some of the soil remediation techniques involve those small changes in the geochemical environment and the soil water to mobilize the contaminants so you can suck them out. The long-term performance of these things, I think, is still very much an open-ended question. Now, here in Maryland, Alan Davis at University of Maryland has done a lot of experimental work
on rain gardens, the removal of stormwater urban contaminants through different planting mixes, you know, in rain gardens and bioretention structures. The kicker is, part of putting in a rain garden, like any stormwater management practice, requires you to maintain it. And part of the maintenance for a rain garden or a bioretention structure is to take out the contaminated planting mix every few years and replace it, and you have to dispose of it. To do that in pervious concrete, you start with a jackhammer. So there's anecdotal information. There's some very interesting work coming out of Europe where people are actually trying to design and structure the subgrade geometry to keep some permanent pools in there. Because part of the problem of hoping that biological processes are going to be active here is it's one thing to have native bacteria in groundwater where you have long residence times and pretty stable conditions. You know, in these facilities, we're flushing them, really high rates of, you know, through flow and loading, and then they're drying out. And to expect to be able to control that the way we would control an engineering treatment process, that's pretty hard to design in a passive system. So we have some, and there's a lot of papers that say, we looked at the soil where we're doing this and we found contaminants. Obviously, the soils are removing some of the contaminants. Well, there's very few sites that are actually monitored. The Villanova site that I showed you today, Rob Traber is doing that. We're doing that in some of our sites where we're sampling the water quality going through the pavement before it hits the subgrade, just as it gets to the subgrade. And we have water quality monitoring wells we're going to be putting in so that we can do tracer experiments to get a sense of the residence time, what's coming out, and we're actually going to do stable isotopes of nitrogen to see if we see any evidence of denitrification. That can occur, but doing all those experiments just tells us what's happening in the environment of our particular practice. And generalizing that to say all pervious concrete systems everywhere are behaving like this is not a leap of faith that I think we're prepared to make. So there's some, qualitatively, there's lots of good things that can happen to some extent. But my judgment, and it's my experience, is I think we're a ways away from saying, out of sight, out of mind, no problem. Infiltrate the pollutants and the system will take care of it. That's, you know, that's my view anyway. But it's a research challenge, which is good news for us.
The reason why we're asking, I mean, we're here, we've installed the pervious concrete now and all that from our own capital projects, but also doing, John does the stormwater inspections, and I do the development reviews, so now more and more we're having engineers coming to us asking, you know, all right, how does this work? And we're also now starting to get the concerned homeowners or the developers who are asking these, you know, on occasion, very pointed questions about, all right, how does it provide that water quality? And they ask those kinds of things. So this is a great forum to open up that question and provide a good response.
But I just said the same question holds for any infiltration trench.
Sure.
Whether it's a bioretention cell or an infiltration trench or a perfect concrete system. The trouble is getting the concrete off if you have to think.
We're talking about this. I said, I know he said it. I never remember what I've said. I know it's 2 seconds. I heard him say it. This is infiltration practice. That's all this is. This is an infiltration practice. And so it's an infiltration practice like any other infiltration practice, just spread over a much bigger area. So we sort of take on faith in the state that infiltration, as long as it's far enough from a well, 100 feet, and far enough from the house, 10 feet, then it's all good. Right? Isn't that pretty much the way things are written right now? So this is just another infiltration practice.
And the other infiltration practices are a lot cheaper to fix that.
That's right.
Well, I don't think just to say it's an infiltration practice is correct, because at the end of the day, it is to a certain degree creating some form of a filter. And so when you're looking at the pollutants that are coming off the car, the oil that drips off my LG, it's sticking on the surface. And that's going to be broken down by UV and by microbacteria.
And it's a bigger, the big benefit is it's a bigger area.
Correct.
That is spread out instead of constant.
I'm just wondering if anybody is researching a more durable, coarse paving material that you can use for the heavy turning actions with trucks or drop-off locations right there. I don't know, just something where you don't have to limit it to only the part on the paves.
I think it goes down like the last half of the slab out here. You find for, you've got a lot of applications that have got active truck traffic, steering, and forklifts. If the top four rocks are connected like they should be, the pace is performing, you've got good load transfer between the aggregate, it's more durable than oil presentation.
But yes, there is no doubt boards out behind those latex is available, and some of the local producers even put latex, have latex available in there. So there is more exotic binders. Obviously, it's going to make cost more.
So if somebody comes in and says, you know, I'd like to do it, and I want to do my whole parking lot or do a, you know, residential road or something, I don't know, like that.
Some of the specialty admixtures will double the price.
You might be looking at a proprietary product, isn't it? Well, or a producer might come up with a proprietary mix to give you, you know, 1-7 to 700 PSI flex performance characteristics. Sure, I know that it can be developed, but it might be a proprietary or a contract.
Have you ever seen rebar in coarse pavement? Or ever installed it?
Epoxy coated or stainless chromium rebar?
Yeah.
Or glass down?
Does it help?
I got reservations about it. It's hard to get fully consolidated around. And we had a Homeland Security thing in Long Beach that had a map, a 10-inch center. And it was just a ridiculous process to try to get any kind of consolidation around that bar, and really fibers are the answer.
Plus, from a structural standpoint, I mean, when you talk about the rebar, you know, you talk about development lengths, I mean, that's what it provides. And you're talking, again, you're looking at bond, all right, and ACI codes and everything were based upon, you know, ordinary Portland cement concrete, and, you know, a lot have gone into those development lengths that science doesn't exist for. No fines. But right now, I've only seen it just plain ordinary.
Just like to add that in the asphalt industry, when they came up with a similar mix, which they call the gap graded mix,
yes.
They have to use fiber reinforcement in order to keep these aggregates together. Otherwise, the binding would not be there if you place it on the beltway or on roadways where you have high speed. So that's why I asked you earlier if there has been such attempts to reinforce this material so that it can take more shear stress.
A lot of producers are a lot of working with synthetic fibers. And it was also mentioned that it also helps in terms of stability and placing it.
Also helps as well.
There's a lot of advantages to using synthetic fibers.
And did they come up with good results or is it on their own research?
Conclusion. Yeah. And when I was at university, they did a lot of testing on that.
Question answered for that. Keep in mind, asphalt is a thermal plastic material, and the effective paste is hard. They're different materials.
Yes, we're a rigid material.
Yeah, porous asphalt will typically form about 18 months because of the migration of those paste components down.
How did you get it to work with the truss manufacturer for all the heavy truck traffic with their exotic binders there?
How I did it?
Yeah.
I held a big bond and I said that it had to work and it was entirely the fault of the contractor who was also the material supplier in this case. And made him stamp the plans on like every sheet. And they made it very thick. I think it was 8 inches.
So
and quite a bit of stone under it.
So it's more a function of the
depth. And of course, they did find, And they've come back with a lot of improvements in 7 years. And they've come back and they put it as a denser version, but they did not do, which surprised me. Even where the forklift turned, they put back porous. I thought that they would put back concrete in those areas where that happened. Nope, they put back porous. They wanted to work.
And
it's holding them well.
So,
I put all that on them. I didn't. I didn't. It's a. I didn't try to do that at all myself.
But did they go full depth on that return?
Absolutely, right down to the stone.
When you look at a rigid pavement with a good base, it's the repetition that kills you, not the unnecessary load.
Oh, but you showed there with the fatigue.
Very seldom do concrete pavements fail in fatigue. Jim, what you're talking about there on the pointless, it's a problem you see in industrial floors and warehouses all the time, and they fill those joints. Used to fill them with lead, I don't think you do that anymore. But you'll fill those joints so that when the hard-tired forklifts cross the joint, they're not tearing up the edges. So you're talking about two different things. The fatigue is a loaded thing, but the surface raveling and tearing up is a surface durability issue.
And that's due to the seam where they came together?
The seam or improper curing on a whole floor or slab or whatever.
There you go. I didn't learn anything else today. That was good.
You talk about the Conowego, they do go out there, but they do have to do maintenance on that.
Oh, I think every year.
They go back and they repair sections.
But see, they're also, the guys are very reasonable. And they are, when they're, of course, when the economy improves so much, they have a plan into this to expand that building. And they're going to expand it with more of the force payments. So they hold up a generation of that. They've notified it.
So what are the UC tests that should be done for this material at the plant, at the batch plant, and at the field and site?
Well, it's a whole different group of things. We're measuring the aggregate to start with, and an inspector should verify the load report. All the loads should indicate exactly what the actual batch contains and verify that it matches the mix design. Also timing, the exposure from when it leaves the mixer till it's covered with polysheeting. Those kinds of things are critical attention, which is sort of a non-issue.
But you know, I think you're getting a little bit in means and methods with method to batch plan. However, for example, with the aerobic gradation, all right, because the moisture content of the aerobic is extremely important in order to control your total water content to get your consistency. And you've got to have good control of the moisture of the aggregate and stockpiling so that he knows what the moisture is. Not only does he know what the moisture is in that pile, but it's the entire pile he's got control of. Okay. Probably more so than conventional concrete because you have the slump adjuster, he's able to do. You don't have good sump control, or it's more difficult to control that consistency as it goes into the truck. So you've got to have a good... You've got to have a better control of the moisture content of your aggregates than you do conventional concrete.
So you don't store it in the yard without sealing on top of it?
Oh, no. You've just got to, generally, ready-mix producer, people go ahead. You want to always batch at what they say above the SSD condition, above 50 standard. You've got to have 50, you don't want to dry, you don't want to batch dry aggregates. So he's got a pile which he is wet. He has had sprinklers on the day before, allowed to drain. Then in the morning he comes and he samples what the moisture content of that area is, and that's the area that he pulls from all day. Meanwhile, new trucks come in, they go to the sinkers for another pile. He's got a whole pile to take care of that production, which he knows what the moisture content is. And he's got, as we mentioned, how gradation is extremely important. He's got control of the gradation.
Yeah, verify that with the end weight and then back it up with a fresh plastic unit.
And
both versions.
We've even done some stuff where that dry rotted unit weight is extremely important. Because conventional concrete has a space that can separate barrier departments. And we've done where we just check the dry rotted unit weight in the morning to make sure that compares with what your design is. But rarely is that change.
And in the field?
What we did is we did the unit weight. Of course, check the patch ticket, make sure that we're getting it verified, things coming in on time. Check the temperatures, make sure the temperature, although it was batched, once it was batched, the temperature was good. We did keep a watch on the time it was placed and the time it was covered. The usual. Just as if you were inspecting formwork, make sure that the form is either covered with poly or that it's sprayed with a release agent. We used a pop coating prior to covering it with plastic.
The evaporation retardant. Generically, it's an evaporation retardant.
Yes. Then we also cast beams because in this particular instance we decided that we wanted to go ahead and try to figure out what the electrical strength was and how it broke. We were more curious to see how it broke than looking at the mortar issue. Or the bonding and how it pulled apart as it was failed. And then we also had there were a couple other criteria that we had. That's what we used.
And for the temperature, was it the air temperature or the surface temperature?
We actually measured the concrete. What I was talking about is measuring time. We know that it's closer by far for HCI and ASTM with some real hard ideas, but at the present time we're kind of working towards what we think needs to be. I can only tell you the product that we ended up with was today. It's performed extremely well. We have another project that was done. We had nothing other than an oversight issue with has a terrible rattling problem. We're trying to determine exactly where that problem came from. We suspect it may be a case of after they placed it, they covered it, but they did not keep it covered long enough. So we ended up with
that'd be another thing to watch on the site is the ongoing curing process. Make sure the wind is not getting right now.
Yeah, that was one thing that we did do. Worked with the client very closely, and also the contractor. We kept everything covered for 10 days rather than just 7 days. And then we kept everybody off of it. 28 days, and we didn't even put out paint until that 28th day on that parking lot. I think if you take the time to treat visually at the beginning, you'll end up with a product that's serviceable in the end.
And also, enforce the specification. I guess that's what really amounts to.
Is there a weather restriction like foley and rising during the pour, just like regular concrete?
Yes.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing. Enforce that specification. Have somebody on site with the ability to enforce that specification during the pour. Can you get it on within 20 minutes?
What kind of a sampling specification? This would be my first course for you.
You can start with the ACI 522 specification for pours, pervious paving, Now that is not a standalone document. It is in
still
a three-part format. It still needs to be supported by other instructional documents. Especially addresses the geological requirements, the void content, anything specialized in the design. But that's a great construction option.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, I mean, it is a specification, so it's written in mandatory language. So, clearly supported. I've seen some documents that have gone ahead and have specified the committee report, 522, which is just a wish list of how you should do it. It's not enforceable, really,
It's a
good guideline. You certainly can steal from that. All right, if you want it to write specification.
When we did our specification, basically, everywhere got kind of grabbed towards consensus, and then we went, does this make sense? And that's what we came up with, the specification for the project.
I really thought your comments about paying attention to hydration and matching it to particle size distribution in your aggregate just really excited. People are not talking about that. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about doing that on the fly and what's involved beyond the sort of metallic sheen kind of, you know.
Yeah, I think the trouble comes from the thought that it's a noble gesture to back off the water. Talking about water convenience up on that scale, that's true. We're so dangerously close to the bottom end of this. Turn the pattern of water to complete the chemistry, make the physical nature of that paste do what we're trying to make it do. A critical content of water there. So getting it in there to start with, and also preserving that water through the whole installation, maintaining the humidity as that goes on to the curing time really is. And the reason I go nutty on it is it's such a critical cause of failure. We go around and see what groups are made. You know, we can weep about them and all, but we can also learn about what they did wrong there. In so many cases, just it's predictable. They're going to starve out the water because they're afraid of flooding the mix. And getting all that particulate size and all that void space apportionment respected and preserved in this is really the main effort there is all about leaving space for the water and that water to come up and supply it. You notice the first part of the slab in place out here. We should have got here a little quicker to wipe that up, but in hindsight, it's maybe good to see something a little too dry, a bit unmanageable. You see how it's bearing open, being really kind of rude. Management. Once we reached a point of moisture content, stuff was almost self-consolidating and readily squeezed in. And as we strike it, we get a very consistent pressure and uniformity on that rock. Really is not present if it's starving for water. And you know, I have to recognize that it takes at least 0.25, 0.26 to accomplish that, to complete that chemistry. But you see guys all the time that are starting it down to 1.5, 2.0. And the end result is you've got dead cement laying there that was in the way, causing an unmanageable problem for the creek to start with. But it's wasted cement. Water's really a critical thing here in keeping that humidity.
Yeah,
the
concrete that was up there today have the sheen material?
No. It was flat and dull as convenience store. And that combined with our hydration was kicking in. Even though we had a good dose of hydration stabilizer, that hot water was not treating as well. And I could feel more but when that about 80 degrees there. Things were starting to take off there. We were running out of time. But those symptoms were aggravated by being starved and mixed in a dry condition, generating a lot of heat and friction there, which is otherwise a lot more friendly and wet and folding when it's got adequate water. But there's a point at which it's not enough, but you put just a little bit more water in and everything turns firm. That's why they talk about that wet metallic sheen, because that becomes quite visible when things are coming. That's true, but here again, the problem with it mix that's out of balance, which makes you heavy or too rich, is that the only way you can keep that from plugging is to start out the water. Keep it fluffy and lift, which is a goof balance.
Do you guys always have to push it through the chute, or does it come down on its own?
It will come right down, if it's right down. I don't want to spook anybody, but you can really drive the field test technician nutty with a slow mo. Impervious.
Okay.
Bring it out, turn it upside down, okay? Fill it with pervious, poke it full, level it off, lift it off, okay? If it falls out, it's too wet. If you give it a little shake and it will slide out, it's just about right. But if you give it a little wiggle and it won't come, let's do that right. Okay? You're counting on that paste being so flexible and workable with enough moisture in it that it will yield and let that rock come back together and touch other rock. If you separate that rock with a little bit of paste, you're subject to all the frailties of the paste. The strength drops right off. Shrinks, curls, warps.
Love
but
it.
It's a magic thing about first. It stays where you put it and doesn't shrink if it's got that point to point contact with the rock.
Another problem comes also in slump, using a slump cap, is if you, first of all, we're assuming that the technician on site has one that is not rough. In good shape. You should be wetting down the slump head before you go ahead and run it. Well, you're also trying to ride it. It doesn't lend itself at all at any time to doing a slump. It sometimes sticks to the sides, and it just would not recommend it.
Even 143 says that those slumps,
the minute you turn the slump from upside down,
it
will slump.
I
really cling to that snowball test, but I disagree with the consistency that they're saying it is right. If you try to form a ball, you shouldn't quite be able to make it stay in a firm ball. It should sink away. That's a lot of the art form of targeting water, having an eye for what you're looking for there. But it becomes a lot easier if you don't have to worry about plugging the slab as you're targeting that moisture content in the paint.
So any thoughts on how we might be able to address more consistent hydration with something quantitative or specification? Or is it really going to rely on having experience?
Still in an art form. You know, I pass it on that spreadsheet differently. But it's just a very basic elementary plant that maybe the materials are stuck
together. We played around with the moisture.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's close.
Or a soil moisture meter type test.
Yeah, but then it's got to be, it's got to be, quote, calibrated to the right consistency. And that can be done in the test.
It also comes to vary a lot just from the surface texture of the aggregate itself. Find a big difference between natural gravel and a crushed stone. That sharp angular fracture makes it come together a different way and respond.
We got already about a couple of handouts.
Yes, yes, sir.
MarylandConcrete.com.
MarylandConcrete.com, there you go. Okay, it'll take a couple of days probably for...
A couple of days? I'm not that fast. It'll take a little bit because we want to put the videos up and everything.
Some of the files are pretty big, so I don't know how they're going to condense them and get them in the right format. Steve, I'm sorry.
We'll figure it out. You'll get an email.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
You watch it?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
I think you. I don't think this is like.